Chapter 21. The Engineer. As Deputy Special Agent in charge of security for President Clinton, Lou Merletti prepared for travel to Israel, Syria, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait. It was October 19, 1994. The focus of the trip was peace in the Middle East, but all Merletti could think about were assassination attempts and potential mass casualty attacks against his protectees. No fan of CIA covert operations, President Clinton was pursuing diplomacy instead, always the first option for a commander-in-chief. The centerpiece of this trip was the historic signing of the Israel-Jordan Peace Treaty, set to take place on October 26 in a tiny border town between the two warring nations. If successful, the signing ceremony would be a step toward peace in the Middle East, progress not seen since the Camp David Accords of 1978. Then, in advance of the visit, the Shin Bet updated the Secret Service with escalated threat information. It involved a Hamas bomb maker who went by the nom de guerre, the Engineer. The Palestinian terror organization Hamas had recently declared war against Israel, setting off a wave of guerrilla warfare tactics, including hit-and-run killings, assassinations, and now suicide bombings. Since its official establishment in 1987, Hamas maintained a hit squad called Majmuat Jihad Udawa, a strike force trained to kill Palestinians suspected of cooperating with Israel. Hamas called these traitors moral deviants and made their deaths public to serve as a warning to others. Israel, as the Jewish state, must disappear from the map, declared Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the nearly blind quadriplegic founder of Hamas, wheelchair-bound since a wrestling accident at the age of 12. Palestine was and would always be Islamic land, Sheikh Yassin said, consecrated for future Muslim generations until Judgment Day. After the end of the Gulf War in 1991, and with rumblings that Yasser Arafat was considering making peace with Israel, Hamas vowed to take power from the PLO. The Hamas assassination squad was folded into the group's military wing, the Ezzedine al-Qassam Brigades. Without a standing army, the organization relied on guerrilla warfare tactics. Suicide bombings became the new focus for Hamas, the work of a shy electrical engineer from Bir Zeit University in the West Bank named Yahya Ayash, also known as the Engineer. To date, he'd built 4 suicide bombs that killed 15 people and injured 39. The lethality of a suicide bomb attack is contingent upon the size of the bomb. In 1994, the master bomb makers in the Middle East were with Hezbollah, Shia Muslims. Hamas was an organization made up of Sunni Muslims. Because militants from these two branches of Islam were engaged in their own sectarian wars, terrorists from Hezbollah and Hamas did not generally mix. When Sudan hosted a terror conference, the Arab Islamic People's Congress, in April 1991, the CIA feared this calculus might change. Hamas leader Khalid Mashal attended, and so had Imad Mughniya, Hezbollah operations chief. Now, the Shin Bet had information suggesting that a pernicious new partnership between these two organizations might be underway. Yahya Ayash had been on the run. He and other Hamas members were said to be living in a refugee camp in Lebanon, just over the border from Israel. The place was built into a hillside and difficult to get to, with Lebanese media reporting that convoys of donkeys and mules were bringing supplies into the Hamas fighters living there, including weatherproof tents, food, clothes, and supplies. Then came the military and terrorism instructors from Hezbollah, says Ronan Bergman. Imad Mughniya himself came to the camp to talk with Ayash and some of his comrades. Were Hamas and Hezbollah working together? With Imad Mughniya's training, the power of the engineers' bombs could grow exponentially more lethal. In Washington, Lou Merletti, bags packed, was preparing to leave for the Middle East when the deadliest suicide bombing in Israel's history rocked the center of Tel Aviv, just a few blocks from where President Clinton's motorcade was scheduled to travel. The bomb had been built by the engineer. It was morning rush hour, and the number 5 passenger bus was heading down Rothschild Boulevard toward Dinzigov Street, the Champs-Élysées of Tel Aviv. Approaching the heart of the café district, a tall, thin, 27-year-old Arab man from the West Bank boarded the bus, sat down in an aisle seat, and placed a small brown bag at his feet. A thin wire ran out of the bag through a hole in the man's trousers, up his leg and into his pocket. There, it connected to an electrical switch, which connected to an improvised explosive device, IED, containing 20 kilograms of military-grade TNT and wrapped in nails and screws. At 8:56, the suicide bomber in the aisle seat flipped the electrical switch in his pocket. The heat and blast produced a fireball so intense, it separated the vehicle's cabin from its chassis, melted the fiberglass frame, crushed a nearby car, and shattered windows all down the street. In a flash, 22 people were ripped apart, their limbs hurled across the street, where they landed on cafe floors and up in the branches of the chinaberry trees. Dazed and in shock, a young hairdresser who'd been riding the bus to work miraculously survived. "I saw fire," she told a journalist. "I saw a woman without a face." Orthodox men in long black cloaks appeared on the scene, carrying plastic bags and tweezers, which they used to pick up fingers, toes, and pieces of skin. Even the most hardened Israeli counterterrorism officers found the carnage too much to bear. A uniformed soldier vomited in the street. "How much more can we take?" screamed a young girl, her face and hands covered in blood. 22 people were dead, 50 injured. Reporters took to the streets, seeking opinions on whether or not the peace treaty could survive. "If peace comes only from one side, ours, it isn't peace," store owner Moshe Barr told a journalist with a camera, emphasizing the word ours. Susanna Halperin, a passenger on the bus who'd been hospitalized for burns, shared a different opinion. "I want the peace process to continue," she said. "I want my children to live in peace." But as the hours wore on, the ancient, archetypal desire for revenge reemerged. "Death to the Arabs," shouted the growing crowd, as Kevlar-clad security forces worked to quell riots. In Gaza and the West Bank, vendors took to the streets, selling T-shirts emblazoned with the image of the engineer. To many Palestinians, Yahya Ayash was the new face of the revolution. For the Shin Bet, he was the most wanted man in Israel. Lou Merletti traveled to Andrews Air Force Base, accompanied by a military aide and several staffers. They boarded a 10-person aircraft and flew to the Middle East, with Merletti now leading the advance trip for President Clinton's security. Typically, the DSAC, Deputy Special Agent in Charge, and the SAC, Special Agent in Charge, travel with the president. But the threat associated with this trip was unprecedented, Merletti explains. "I would now visit each of the country's top security official for 6 or 8 hours. We would go over security and then fly to the next country." It was my job to make sure each of the host nations understood without any hesitation what was required of them by us, Merletti says. The first stop was Tel Aviv. I was focused on the threat, he remembers. We were aware of the engineer. To protect the president inside the United States has its challenges, Merletti explains, but the Secret Service is a highly efficient security machine. Counter-snipers with shoot-to-kill orders are positioned atop buildings, prepared to neutralize anyone who takes aim at the president. Counter-assault teams are ready to repel an attack with overwhelming force. Protection of the president overseas is an entirely different ballgame, says Merletti. We just don't take that lightly. While the team was airborne, President Clinton issued a statement on the Hamas bombing, calling it an outrage against the conscience of the world, and vowed it would have no impact on his diplomatic efforts toward a real and lasting peace in the Middle East. After landing in Tel Aviv, Merletti and his team traveled to the King David Hotel in Jerusalem and checked in. Merletti had with him an 18-point security plan, which he intended to share with his Shin Bet counterpoint, Benny Lahav. All 18 requirements had to be met, Merletti would insist. We couldn't settle for anything less, not in this environment. Israel was a particularly dangerous place at this moment in time. Hamas's mass casualty attack against the number 5 passenger bus the day before had likely emboldened them. With their expressly stated goal of stopping the peace process, Hamas saw President Clinton as a high-value target, HVT. While in Israel, Clinton's security detail would be jointly run by the U.S. Secret Service and the Shin Bet. On two separate occasions, the president would be out in the open, says Merletti, the most challenging environment to defend against. After a partial night's sleep, Merletti traveled to Tel Aviv to meet with Benny Lahav, who served as assistant director for the Shin Bet Protective Division, responsible for Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's personal security detail. Merletti recalls feeling unsettled during the meeting. We did not see eye to eye on the 18 points. A contentious discussion ensued. Their attitude, I recall, was to solve problems through use of force. I was flabbergasted and frustrated, Merletti says. But after 2 hours, Lahav conceded 17 of the 18 criteria the Secret Service demanded for the visit. The point I didn't get was CAT, counter-assault team, coming to Israel. Most foreign countries were very sensitive about allowing CAT in because most foreign countries viewed CAT as a military-type unit. With the meeting over, Merletti headed off on a fast-paced trip, meeting with the heads of security for the foreign leaders of Syria, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait. It was a tough few days, Merletti recalls, and he felt the greatest pressure when the president was in Israel. At one point, when we were out in the open with the president, it was clear to me that a Shin Bet agent named S, redacted, was not paying attention to the degree that the U.S. Secret Service requires. Agent S was not watching his area. Without saying too much about security, I can tell you that arrivals and departures are critical times. In these areas, there can never be lapses or holes. Concerned for the president's safety, Merletti spoke directly to Agent S about this issue. He said something along the lines of, "If any threat approaches, we're going to spray bullets, ask questions later." I was kind of appalled. For U.S. Secret Service agents, protecting the president is like going on a mission in the jungle behind enemy lines, Merletti believes. A sniper, a hit-and-run grenade attack, a firefight, an ambush, anything is possible at any time. You had to accept and prepare for this. That's how I was trained. On October 25, 1994, with high hopes for peace and security in the Middle East, President Clinton began a six-nation tour with Lou Merletti always within arm's reach. In Damascus, Clinton met with Hafez al-Assad, the first American president to meet with the president of Syria in more than 20 years. During the visit, Assad lauded Syria's capital as one of the oldest, continuously inhabited cities in the world, a region that played a role in the dawn of human civilizations. Syria is committed to the peace process, Assad promised. We aspire to transform the region from a state of war to a state of peace. In 1994, Syria had been on the U.S. State Department's State Sponsors of Terrorism list longer than any other nation, a record it still holds in 2019. In Cairo, President Clinton met with President Mubarak and Yasser Arafat. 2 weeks prior, Arafat had been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Foreign Minister Shimon Peres. In King Khalid Military City, Saudi Arabia, Clinton met with King Fahd, who praised the relentless efforts of President Clinton and his government to move ahead the peace process. In Kuwait City, he met with the Emir of Kuwait. It had been only a year since Clinton's predecessor, former President George H.W. Bush, had been the target of an Iraqi assassination plot. In a region wrought by centuries of conflict and bloodshed, could these neighbor nations really put aside their blood feuds and live in peace? President Clinton was the first American president since Carter to pursue peace, not covert action, in the Middle East. At a border crossing between Jordan and Israel, Lou Merletti stood behind the president in the bright sun, while the first-ever peace treaty between Israel and Jordan was signed by Prime Ministers Yitzhak Rabin and King Hussein of Jordan, ending 46 years of enmity. "This vast, bleak desert hides great signs of life," said President Clinton. "Peace between Jordan and Israel is no longer a mirage. It is real." Jordan was now the second Arab nation to enter into a peace agreement with Israel. Egypt had been the first 16 years earlier in September 1978. 3 years later, Anwar Sadat was assassinated. Was it an auspicious time or a time of ominous foreboding? No one could predict. When it came time to leave Israel, Merletti felt compelled to speak out to Benny Lahav of the Shin Bet. "I was standing at the bottom of the steps of Air Force One, about to board. Someone made a remark, kind of suggesting I was overzealous. Lahav pointed out that everything had worked out fine. He asked if I had anything else to say about Shin Bet security." Merletti thought about his experiences in Vietnam, and specifically of Mike Karopas, his friend and fellow soldier who died just after turning 22, before he ever had a chance to really shine. Merletti decided he was unwilling to stay silent. "So I said, 'You're weak on arrivals and departures, and Agent S doesn't understand protection. Someone is going to get hurt.' Then I climbed the stairs and boarded Air Force One." Merletti took his seat, located just a few feet from the door to the private cabin for the President of the United States. For the first time in days, he was able to really sleep. From a security standpoint, the trip was a success, and this was also true from a diplomatic perspective. But not everyone felt triumphant. During the signing of the peace accord, as celebratory balloons were released into the hot desert air, Hezbollah, headquartered in nearby Lebanon and financed by Iran, fired rockets into Israeli villages in northern Galilee. As the details of the treaty emerged, Yasser Arafat became enraged. "Anyone dumb enough to abide by it could drink Gaza seawater," Arafat fumed. At the urging of Hamas and the PLO, more than 1 million Palestinians went on strike, declaring a day of mourning in protest. But no one could have predicted that the greatest direct threat to the safety and security of Israel's prime minister was not necessarily from Hamas or Hezbollah. Peril was brewing at home, within a group of radical, nationalistic, right-wing Orthodox Jews. They saw Rabin as a traitor to their hardline views and took to the streets to burn effigies of him. "Death to Rabin!" they shouted from parades and from podiums where they gathered. One of their members, a 25-year-old Jewish law student named Yigal Amir, had been experimenting with homemade bullets inside his garage. During the first week of May 1995, Prime Minister Rabin traveled to Washington, D.C., where he met with President Clinton at the White House. The Shin Bet agent Benny Lahav led the detail. "We recognized one another immediately," Merletti recalls. "Benny Lahav said to me, 'I'd like you to come have lunch with me over at the hotel we're staying at.'" Lahav had something important to tell Merletti, he said. Over lunch, he asked Merletti if he remembered the argument the two of them had had in Israel over the 18 points of security the Secret Service strongly requested from the Shin Bet. Merletti told Lahav that of course he did. The way Merletti recalls the conversation, Lahav then shared with him some thoughts about the Americans' hypervigilance. "Benny Lahav told me, 'A man always has to fight for what he believes is right.' Lahav said, 'Let me tell you, if Rabin were ever hurt, it would be my head. And if Clinton were ever hurt, it would be your head.'" Merletti knew Lahav's words were the truth. 4 months later, on September 3, 1995, Lou Merletti was promoted to special agent in charge of the Presidential Protective Division. With the exception of director, this was the highest position a Secret Service agent could hold. When Merletti moved into his new office, he brought with him items that reminded him of what was at stake: gravestone rubbings of his friends who died fighting in Vietnam. 2 months later, on Saturday, November 4, 1995, Lou Merletti was at his son's football game when his pager went off. The message indicated that the situation was urgent. Merletti ran to his car and used his Secret Service-issued cellular telephone. "They said there had been an assassination of a world leader," he remembers. On the drive to the White House, a breaking news story came over the radio. Yitzhak Rabin had been killed in Tel Aviv. As Merletti sat there stunned, the telephone in his car rang. It was President Clinton calling. He said to me something along the lines of, "You heard what happened. I have to go to the funeral. I need to talk to you. I need you to be on board with this." Because the funeral was in 2 days, travel would have to happen in a matter of hours, Merletti remembers. I said to him, "If you want to go, we'll go. But we need you to do everything we tell you to do. We're going to go to Israel and we'll do what we plan on doing. There can be no side events, and if we determine there's something we can't do, we're not doing it." The president agreed. Travel had to happen in a matter of hours. Merletti went home, changed his clothes, and drove to the White House. The situation was frenetic, people racing around trying to prepare staff for the trip. There were difficult logistics to sort out. This was not a normal group of people traveling to the funeral for Yitzhak Rabin, he recalls. There would be 3 living presidents traveling to Israel on Air Force One: President Clinton, former President Jimmy Carter, and former President George H.W. Bush. Also in the delegation were White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta, House Minority Leader Newt Gingrich, Speaker of the House and Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole, Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle, and others. Besides the vice president, who stayed in Washington, nearly the entire line of presidential succession was on the plane. On the flight over, Merletti gave a security briefing and took questions. What everyone wanted to know was, how was Rabin assassinated? But Merletti had no idea. The delegation arrived in Tel Aviv, drove up the mountain into Jerusalem, and checked into the King David Hotel. A guy came up to me and introduced himself from the Shin Bet, Merletti recalls. He said, "The director, Carmen Gillan, wants to meet with you right now." The first thing that went through my mind was, ah, there's been another assassination attempt. It was almost midnight. The funeral was the following day. Whatever it was had to be important enough that it couldn't wait. Merletti told his deputy he'd be right back. The Shin Bet agents whisked him into a car and drove away. It was dark outside and the streets were narrow. The car moved quickly through what felt like Jerusalem's back alleyways and up to a darkened restaurant that looked closed. The agents got out of the car and motioned for Merletti to follow. One of them tapped on a door. The window blind separated and a man peeked out. The door opened. Inside the restaurant, the chairs were all up on the tables. The place was definitely closed. Merletti was taken through the front room and into a much smaller room at the back. There was a big table in there, with all these men sitting there in a row under very bright lights. Merletti remembers thinking to himself, what on earth is going on? Carmi Gillon introduced himself. He said, I'm the director of the Shin Bet. Are you Lou Merletti? Merletti said he was. Gillon said, I was told, so I'm asking you, is this true that last year when you were here, you said the Shin Bet was weak on arrivals and departures, and that Agent S, redacted, didn't know what he was doing? Merletti told Gillon, yes, that's what he said. Gillon asked Merletti if he knew how the prime minister was killed, if he was aware of the details of the assassination of Rabin. Merletti said no. It was on a departure, just as you predicted, Gillon said, and told Merletti that the advance agent was Agent S, redacted. That Agent S was standing next to Rabin when he was shot. Merletti felt sick. And do you know who was standing next to Agent S? Gillon asked. No, Merletti said. Benny Lahav, Gillon said. There was a coda to the tragedy. Gillon asked Merletti if the U.S. Secret Service would be willing to train Shin Bet agents on arrivals and departures, as well as other security protocols that remain classified. Merletti said he would introduce Gillon to the appropriate people. The men shook hands, and the Shin Bet agents took Merletti back to the King David Hotel. When Israel's Shamgar Commission released its report on the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, Shin Bet agent Benny Lahav was singled out and fired. Agent S, redacted, resigned. Carmi Gillon assumed full responsibility for the security failures and resigned. The state funeral at Jerusalem's Mount Herzl Cemetery was a solemn affair. President Clinton read a eulogy that remained focused on peace, which he referenced 9 times. After the service ended, the delegation drove back down the mountain, boarded Air Force One, and flew home. There was a second coda, which, like the first, has never been reported. Rabin's assassination was for many Israeli Jews a time of great suffering and soul-searching. Hamas took advantage of the national despair, upping its irregular warfare campaign with lethality unmatched in its prior terror campaigns. Over a 1-month period in February and March, more than 60 Israelis were killed in a wave of suicide bomb attacks. The explosive devices were built by Yahya Ayash. The hunt for the engineer accelerated, and the Shin Bet asked the U.S. Secret Service for assistance. The exact role of the partnership remains classified, but it involved surveillance equipment used by Gray Fox, the Army's classified intelligence unit and CIA partner. This technology was lent to the Shin Bet in its hunt for the engineer. Meanwhile, in the United States, a technology development in the private sector was giving the U.S. Secret Service grave concerns. Mobile phones had recently become popular. As special agent in charge of the PPD, Lou Merletti was having great difficulty making the affable president understand the danger in holding someone else's phone. On one occasion, recalls Merletti, an individual in a crowd held out her cell phone and asked the president to say hello to her mom. President Clinton obliged. Merletti suggested to the president that he should not receive any object, including a cell phone, that wasn't approved by the Secret Service first. The president noted the request and seemed to agree. But a few weeks later, a similar situation came to pass. Then it happened a third time. I spoke to him in the car, recalls Lou Merletti. I said, Mr. President, you must understand how serious the threat is. You can't take a cell phone from anyone, not unless it has been approved by us first. Merletti was privy to information about the engineer that had not yet been made public. Shin Bet operators learned that the Hamas bomb maker would sometimes spend the night in the Gaza City home of a childhood friend named Osama Hamad. In order to speak with Hamas leaders clandestinely, the engineer would sometimes borrow Osama Hamad's cell phone. The Shin Bet had previously used an uncle of Osama Hamad's, a man named Kamil Hamad, as a paid informant. In the fall of 1995, the Shin Bet blackmailed the uncle into working for them, threatening to tell Hamas of his treachery if he didn't honor a simple request. The Shin Bet gave the uncle a cell phone and told him it needed to be put into the hands of the engineer. The Shin Bet said it wanted to listen to the engineer's conversations with Hamas. The uncle was not made privy to the fact that the cell phone was an engineered explosive device outfitted with 15 grams of RDX explosives. On January 5, 1996, while visiting with his childhood friend, the engineer received a call from his father on Osama Hamad's cell phone. Overhead, an Israeli SIGINT aircraft, equipped with technology provided by the U.S. Secret Service, listened in on the call. When voice recognition software confirmed the caller ID, the Shin Bet remotely detonated the cell phone bomb, instantly killing the engineer. With the Hamas bomb maker assassinated, Lou Merletti requested from his Shin Bet counterparts two post-mortem photographs of the engineer. The Shin Bet obliged. I went to see the president, Merletti says. I set down the photographs on his desk and asked him to take a look. The first was a photograph of the bomber's head, the side opposite from where the cell phone had been. The man was clearly dead, but the gruesome results of the cell phone explosion were not evident. Clinton took note, then moved on to the second photograph. The second photograph had been taken from the side where the engineer had been holding the cell phone containing the explosive charge. This side of the engineer's head was almost entirely destroyed. Merletti's recollection is that President Clinton never again accepted another cell phone that had not been handed to him by a Secret Service agent. In the summer of 1996, in Khartoum, Hassan al-Turabi banished Osama bin Laden and his followers from the country. The al-Qaeda leader and his entourage moved to Afghanistan, where they were given sanctuary by the Taliban, the militant Islamist group who'd recently seized the capital city of Kabul. In a financial arrangement with Taliban leader Mullah Omar, bin Laden began to expand his al-Qaeda organization by setting up terrorist training camps in Afghanistan, where fighters prepared for jihad against the United States. Osama bin Laden's first target, not widely known, was President Clinton. It was November 24, 1996, and Loomer Letty accompanied President Clinton to the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum in the Philippines. Security was intense, with an estimated 26,000 police and soldiers assigned to protect visiting dignitaries. The U.S. State Department warned its citizens to be on alert for a possible terrorist attack. In Manila, President Clinton was scheduled to visit a local politician. The route chosen would take him across a bridge in central Manila. As the presidential motorcade began to move, recalled Merletti, he received a crackly message in one earpiece. Intelligence agents had picked up a message using the words bridge and wedding, which Merletti interpreted to be terrorist code words for assassination. Merletti ordered the motorcade to change course, something only he had the authority to do. The motorcade agent, Nelson Garabito, did a great job rerouting the president under those difficult circumstances, he says, and that the agents discovered a bomb on the bridge. The assassination attempt was not made public. The Secret Service keeps all assassination attempts against a U.S. president classified top secret so as not to encourage copycat attacks. The details of the Manila bomb were made known to only a handful of members of the U.S. intelligence community. The following year, on June 6, 1997, Loomer Letty was sworn in as the 19th director of the U.S. Secret Service, the first former counter-assault team member to hold the position, and the only director to have served in the U.S. Army Special Forces in Vietnam. 6 months into the job, in January 1998, Merletti was driving to the White House one morning when he heard NPR reporters Maura Liasson and Robert Siegel interviewing President Clinton. "Is there any truth to the allegation of an affair between you and the young woman?" one of the reporters asked. The president was being accused of having conducted an affair with an intern named Monica Lewinsky and of having asked the Secret Service to help keep it a secret. Merletti was stunned. He was the special agent in charge of the president's security detail at the time this affair was allegedly taking place. He'd never heard a word about it from any of his agents. He hurried back to the White House. "Our chief counsel, John Kelleher, informed me that we would be getting subpoenas from the Office of the Independent Counsel for agents on the president's protective detail to testify in open court." Merletti remembers thinking, "What is this guy Ken Starr thinking? Does he know what this means?" If Secret Service agents were forced to testify against a president, it would rock the foundation of trust and confidence, Merletti believed. Merletti was summoned to Starr's office on Pennsylvania Avenue to speak with the independent counsel and his deputy, Robert J. Bittman. Merletti told Ken Starr that Secret Service agent Clint Hill was living proof that proximity to the president is critical to the success of the Secret Service. As we learned earlier, on the day that President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, there were no Secret Service agents riding on the running boards of the president's limousine. This protocol change, authorized by President Kennedy just a few days earlier, put several yards distance between the president and his protective detail. "Proximity is the difference between life and death to our protectees," Merletti told Starr. "If our protectees cannot trust us, if they believe that they will be called to testify before a grand jury to reveal confidences, the president will not allow us that critical proximity." Ken Starr seemed unconcerned. "It's like it didn't register," Merletti recalls. Instead, he asked questions about lipstick, hair, other things. Merletti was furious. His job was about protection, not politics. A showdown ensued. In May 1998, a judge scheduled a hearing on Merletti's claim that Secret Service agents should be granted a protective function privilege and kept from testifying in open court. Accompanying Merletti was former Secret Service agent Clint Hill. Lawyers for the Secret Service showed the judge rare historical photographs of agents, including Clint Hill, jumping off the rear bumper of the presidential limousine to ride in the vehicle behind on President Kennedy's orders just minutes before heading toward Dealey Plaza in downtown Dallas on November 22, 1963. The case headed to trial. Immunity deals were negotiated. Secret Service agents were forced to testify in court, revealing under oath that they had not known about the Lewinsky affair and had never helped the president keep it secret. In late July, President Clinton volunteered to testify regarding allegations that he'd committed perjury by covering up the affair. In the middle of this unfolding drama, on August 7, 1998, suicide bombers drove truck bombs into the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. Among the 224 people killed in nearly simultaneous explosions were 12 Americans. Another 4,000 people were wounded. The truck bombs were reminiscent of the ones Hezbollah had driven into the U.S. embassy and Marine Corps barracks and the French paratroop barracks in Beirut 15 years before. But the East Africa embassy bombings proved to be the work of Al-Qaeda. 3 months before the embassy attacks in February 1998, Osama bin Laden issued a fatwa against the United States, calling for the murder of any American anywhere on earth as the individual duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible to do it. In May, CIA lawyer John Rizzo drafted a memorandum of notification for a snatch-and-grab operation against bin Laden, an updated version of a Reagan-era finding against Hezbollah. "I had drafted the Reagan finding," says Rizzo. "I wrote it in another era to deal with terrorists in another era. And Clinton had a very different threshold of tolerance for covert action than Reagan had," Rizzo says. His guess was that in the course of trying to capture bin Laden, there'd be a firefight, and the Al-Qaeda chief, and maybe some of the women and children around him, would be killed. Rizzo wrote the memorandum of notification for the president to sign, but Clinton would not sign it, and it was shelved. After the embassy bombings in East Africa, the CIA wanted to kill bin Laden outright, using lethal, direct action by a covert action paramilitary team. President Clinton ordered missile strikes instead. On August 20th, four U.S. Navy ships and a submarine stationed in the Arabian Sea fired between 60 and 75 Tomahawk cruise missiles at terrorist training camps in Khost, Afghanistan, and the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical factory allegedly linked to Osama bin Laden in Khartoum. Billy Waugh was in Sudan on a classified mission at the time. "A colleague and I went by the factory to look at the damage inflicted by the Tomahawks," he says. "It was a big pile of rubble. An unnecessary move, if you ask me." Osama bin Laden was thousands of miles away, still alive as could be. American officials later acknowledged their intelligence on Al-Shifa was thin. Officers at the CIA's counterterrorist center began thinking about how to actually kill Osama bin Laden. John Rizzo drafted another covert action memorandum of notification for President Clinton to sign, one that would allow a team of Afghan assets led by CIA paramilitary operators to go after bin Laden in Afghanistan. But the MON came back with Clinton's handwritten notes, Rizzo recalls, not something I'd ever seen a president do before. "Before lethal direct action could be taken," Clinton noted, "a certain set of conditions had to be met, including the right to self-defense. There were so many caveats and conditions, it muddied the waters and became prohibitive," according to Rizzo. CIA Director George Tenet took a new draft of Rizzo's MON to Attorney General Janet Reno. The Attorney General informed Tenet that she would consider as illegal any CIA operation intended solely to kill bin Laden. There were additional plans in the works aimed at killing Osama bin Laden. Back in 1986, Dewey Claridge, one of the CTC's co-founders, had envisioned using a drone in a targeted killing operation. It was his idea to fly an unmanned aerial vehicle loaded with explosives and ball bearings into Muammar Gaddafi's tent. In the wake of the embassy bombings in East Africa, Kofor Black, now chief of the CTC, and his deputy, Henry Hank Crumpton, had a similar idea. Black allocated a $5 million budget from the CIA's Special Activities Division, authorizing the development of a UAV called the Predator. Originally conceived as a surveillance drone, the 27-foot-long Predator, with its 55-foot wingspan, had a maximum altitude of 25,000 feet and a maximum speed of 138 miles per hour. More importantly, it could hover over a single target for up to 40 hours at a time, take video, and send it back to the CTC. In the summer of 2000, the CIA sent a Predator drone over bin Laden's training base in Afghanistan, Tarnak Farms, outside Kandahar. The Predator gathered video data, identified vehicles, and established a pattern of life. One day, with the Predator watching, bin Laden appeared in the driveway, tall, robed, and surrounded by followers. The CIA was certain it was him. The Clinton White House was notified. The CTC was told it would take 6 hours for the president to sign off on a missile strike against Tarnak Farms. "Unbelievable," recalls Kofor Black. Kofor Black and Hank Crumpton again proposed sending a paramilitary team to Tarnak Farms to kill Osama bin Laden. John Rizzo wrote up another MON. "We were driven by an immediate imperative, find bin Laden, engage in lethal force," Crumpton explained in an interview for this book. "To our frustration, the president's covert action finding included many caveats, stating we could seek to kill Osama bin Laden only if it was part of a capture mission." The situation struck Crumpton as hypocritical. There was no apparent problem killing him with a cruise missile. Kofor Black later gave Crumpton his assessment. "Imagine the pre-9/11 headlines," Black said. "CIA assassinates Saudi militant." Assassination was un-American. No one had the foresight to understand the consequences down the road, Crumpton laments. Herein lies the enigma of preemptive neutralization. In 2000, Kofor Black and Hank Crumpton remained determined to kill bin Laden, but unable to act without a MON, or presidential finding, from the Clinton White House authorizing lethal direct action. "They all but wanted us to take a lawyer from the Justice Department into Afghanistan on a mission," says Black. "Read bin Laden his rights before arresting him." Clinton issued no new findings or MONs on counterterrorism from mid-99 through the end of his administration, not even in the wake of the al-Qaeda bombings of the USS Cole in October 2000, says Rizzo. Hank Crumpton foresaw a solution. "I realized that arming the Predator was perhaps our only chance of achieving our lethal mission," he says. "An armed UAV was more likely to get approval from President Clinton than a covert action strike involving a bullet to the head or chest. Is it the desire for public approval that makes a president loath to kill a man in close quarters combat? To instead defend as legitimate a missile strike costing $75 million to $100 million that kills civilians and destroys buildings in its path? And how would Hank Crumpton's armed Predator drone fit into this calculus? It involved a missile, but it was also a lethal direct action strike intended to kill a single man. With help from White House National Security Council advisor Richard Clark, the CIA's Cofer Black, Charlie Allen, and others, Crumpton explains, the development, testing, and deployment of the armed Predator drone would begin. The pretense of virtue attached to killing someone from a distance is curious, perhaps dangerous as well. The current laws of war prohibit treacherous killing, and that includes assassination. It is also considered treacherous to shoot the enemy while he is taking a bath. But covert action occurs in the in-between, governed by Title 50 of the National Security Code. It is undertaken at the behest of the president and is to remain hidden from the public eye. Do the laws of war need to be updated for guerrilla warfare, seeing as it is the only kind of war America has engaged in since World War II? Can terrorism be defeated by gentlemen's rules? War is wicked, violent, and treacherous, a horror of chaos, anarchy, and revenge. Just ask the covert action operators who run lethal, direct action missions for the CIA's Special Activities Division, including its ground branch, all of which remain classified. I spoke to scores of its operators, some on the condition of anonymity. Where the laws of war end, one ground branch operator told me, ground branch begins.